If you're looking to pore over a copy of a new book on your e-reader, you might struggle to gain access from your local library. That's because a major book publisher has changed its agreements with libraries. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Macmillan now has limits on the number of electronic versions available for lending and when people can access them. So how does this affect you? Are you an ebook user? Do you read books on your phone or your tablet? Do you borrow them from a library? 800-642-1234. How often do you normally wait for your ebooks? Do you get them right away or do you have to wait weeks or months? You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Gold is a project manager for the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium, which provides a digital library service to all Wisconsin residents with a public library card. She describes her job as a librarian for librarians. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Macmillan is one of the country's big five book publishers. What are some of the well-known authors or books we might think of?
So Keely, we have one of the biggest is Nora Roberts. So this Macmillan embargo is really going to affect readers that are very passionate about Nora Roberts. Some others are J.D. Robb, Louise Penny, Lisa Scottolini. These are all what we would call the superseller authors. In addition, we have a lot of book club authors. So Tatiana DeRosny, who did Sarah's Key, Jeffrey Eugenides, who did Middlesex, and Kristen Hanna, who most recently wrote Nightingale. In addition, Macmillan is a very big publisher of children's books and YA books.
So novels, children's books, even graphic novels.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And does Macmillan specialize in fiction or nonfiction, specific topics, or is this really a wide-ranging situation?
I'd say that it's a wide-ranging situation because they are one of the top five publishers, and the top five publishers do publish over 80% of the books that are published today. Macmillan is known for their true crime or their crime and their mystery, as well as the best-selling fiction for adults. And in addition, they do have some top, like Bill O'Reilly is another one that's a big nonfiction author.
Does the company have any authors here in Wisconsin who will be affected by this?
They do. And unfortunately, they have smaller or first-time authors that will be affected by this because libraries will not be able to purchase those titles for the first 8 weeks of publication.
Yeah, let's start breaking this down.
Sure.
So how do people with library cards typically gain access on their end for free to some of these different titles in electronic form?
Sure. So through the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium, also known as the WPLC, any resident of Wisconsin with a public library card can use the collection of ebooks and audiobooks. Most patrons will know the collection as Overdrive or Libby because Libby is a very popular app that is used to access the books. So they basically log into Libby and they are able to get access to, we have 240,000 titles that patrons can access.
And this embargo that you're talking about with Macmillan, this this is limits for new releases, not necessarily some of those of the 100,000 that you have.
Correct. So anything that is being published as of November 1st, anything that is being published now and then going forward will not be able to be purchased by any library. Well, actually, you know what? I misspoke. The libraries will be able to purchase one copy of that title. And so that is like Madison Public Library will be able to have one copy of the Nora Roberts title. The same thing with Darlington Public Library. So it does not matter the size. Obviously, this is going to limit access to patrons around Wisconsin. And the country.
You start with one digital copy. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the library could still invest in 5, 6, 7 hard copies, right? So we're treating them differently.
We are treating them very differently.
Mm-hmm. We're discussing new limits on ebooks and public libraries with Sarah Gold from the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium. And we're wondering what you think about a major publisher limiting library access to new ebooks.
What will you do? Would you buy them instead? Maybe you'd opt out of reading new releases. I mean, are you more likely to go to the library and check out a physical copy of a book? Tell us how it affects your style of reading. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah, before Macmillan announced these new limits, how many copies of ebooks could Wisconsin readers get, beyond that one that they'll now be able to invest in?
They were able to have access to any number of the titles. Typically, it's interesting in ebooks because it's a very different publishers treat ebooks very differently than the print copies. So, for example, with ebooks, they have two different lending models. They have the one copy, one user model, which is called the perpetual access model. You buy it and then you get to keep it forever. Or if the publisher pulls the title for whatever reason. However, those titles can only be checked out one person at a time. There's also another model called the metered access model, which the titles will be available until the licenses, if you will, expire or the time expires.
So it's kind of like a term limit.
It is exactly a term limit. And really, you should think of ebooks and digital audiobooks as being rented rather than owned.
And so why are our librarians or people who go to libraries concerned about this new limit? Is it simply the fact that I might not get the title when I want it?
Well, I think that's a huge part of it, because obviously we are in the business of serving, our patrons, just like we treat them as customers, right, as we would in the retail world. However, in addition, I think it's this chipping away. This is not the first time that this has happened, this sort of tension between publishers and libraries. Really, libraries and publishers should be working together, because libraries are one of the last places that readers can really discover authors and continue to use that discoverability through browsing, through book clubs, through that sort of thing. So I think that's very concerning to libraries overall.
And do we know why Macmillan is scaling back ebook access for libraries? What have they said?
You know, it's interesting that Macmillan is following what a few of the other publishers have done over time. They seem to think in the ebook world, one of the great things about ebooks and digital books is that it reduces the amount of friction. So you don't have to actually go to the library, get out of your car, check out the books, return the books, and that makes some publishers very nervous.
Why?
I think it's because they think that if ebooks are easy to get for free, that people will not purchase them. And we have found that that's simply not true. We have found through research, not research that WPLC has done, but research that the library world has done, that actually library patrons are avid book buyers.
So it doesn't change that for you. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Sarah Gold stays with us. She's a project manager for the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium. And we're talking about limits that publishers are putting on ebooks for libraries. Ebooks, the digital copies where they require zero printing expenses and are free from shipping costs. You're welcome in this discussion. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you borrow ebooks from your local library? What's the process like? Maybe you've considered it, but you prefer physical pages to turn. Share your thoughts at ideas@wpr.org or 800-642-1234. The conversation continues just ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The beauty of digital materials, it's that they have virtually no limit. There's no finite number of hardcovers to poke into our tote bags. And yet that exponential feature of the ebook is a sticking point between publishers that need to make money and libraries that serve readers. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina.
We're talking about the new policy from publisher Macmillan. The agreement includes a restriction. Libraries can get one digital copy of new releases for the first couple of months. And you can join this conversation. How long will you wait before reading a new book? Do you have to get it right away? Or are you okay catching up on it several weeks or even months after its release? 800-642-1234. Go ahead and tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guide is Sarah Gold. She's project manager for the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium. And Sarah, how has readership of ebooks become more common with the popularity of smartphones and the tablets that we have? You don't need a separate reader, an e-reader anymore.
Correct. With the advent of smartphones and tablets, in addition to some wonderful apps that make it literally as easy to touch and download and read a title, ebooks have exploded in terms of especially through libraries. So what we're seeing is that as ebook and audiobook sales are declining in the retail market, they're going through the roof with libraries. In fact, I checked the statistics the other day. We have 5 million checkouts with the Wisconsin Digital Library as of Friday.
And over what amount of time is that?
That would be in less than a year.
Wow. Okay. So So people are accessing it. Do you worry, though, that when you're seeing those numbers increase, that does give credence to this idea that, well, if people have them available for free because the library is taking on the cost, that then they might not buy them? Or do people read them and then purchase copies? How does that all work together?
I think that's actually a really good question. And I don't know if we know that answer. I can tell you that John Sargent, the CEO of Macmillan, seems to think that if he embargoes those copies for 8 weeks, those initial copies of the Macmillan titles, that 8% of the people that would have waited for a copy would go out and buy the book. Now, we're finding we have we're very lucky that we have a patron focus group that has over 1,200 participants. And we do a survey, a patron survey, every year. And for 2018, we asked if you had to wait for a book and you knew that it had over 150 holds, would you buy the book or would you continue, you know, put a hold on it and continue to wait? And the overwhelming majority said they would wait.
So maybe Wisconsin e-readers are a little more patient than Macmillan is betting on in this case.
I think so.
Willing to wait for the product. Mm-hmm. Aside from Macmillan, are we seeing other publishers putting similar limits on libraries when it comes to people being able to check out ebooks?
Well, that's the fear. We do, you know, as I said, there are five major publishers that publish over 80% of the titles out there. And Simon & Schuster has put, for a while, it was Simon & Schuster, Hachette, and Macmillan weren't even selling to libraries. So the books were not available. The titles were not available at all.
And is that in electronic version?
That was in electronic version. Mm-hmm. Only electronic version. And when I speak of this, it really is, again, print available, electronic not. Electronic is often double, sometimes triple the cost of a print book. In addition, print books, you can basically buy them anywhere. Libraries can get them from Amazon. They can get them from their distributors. They can even go to the local bookstore and buy them. That's not the case with ebooks. You have to purchase them through a distributor, and the prices are fixed, and the lending terms are fixed.
And what is the justification then for the higher rate of ebooks if they don't require printing? You're not using paper. You're not paying shipping costs to get them to the places where people are going to read them.
I think it's they are seeing the other side of the coin, where because it's so much easier to get the ebooks, they better get the money where they can. And I have to say that's a little bit of my own opinion, but it seems to be playing out all over.
We're talking about new limits on ebooks at public libraries. Sarah Gold is our guide. She describes her work as being a librarian for librarians. I'm Keely Boltina, and we have room for you. Are you an e-reader? Do you prefer to flip through paper books? What's your take on a major book publisher limiting your library's access to new ebooks? 800-642-1234. We've got a line for you at 800-642-1234. Sarah, some Wisconsin libraries have suggested that we should permanently halt buying Macmillan books because of this. Instead, they'd buy books from more friendlier publishers. What's your take on that idea?
Well, the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium is meeting to discuss a lot of different options. For right now, they have made the decision not to purchase any Macmillan titles in ebook for that first 8 weeks of the embargo. So November 1st to, I believe, December 20th. If patrons do go to the Wisconsin Digital Library, they will see a message that says why or that Macmillan is limiting access to those titles. Hopefully that will do a little to explain the waits. To be honest, this is such a popular collection. There are typically substantial waits for titles that are not always available.
So people might be used to having to wait already?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What, though, about more long-term, if you're waiting these 8 weeks, but then you're investing in the product anyway because it's what your audience needs, how do you deal with that tension?
Well, that's something that we struggle with. One thing that we are doing, although we talk a lot about the top five publishers, there are a whole wealth of publishers out there that have very friendly library terms. For example, they will allow patrons to check out the book simultaneously. We are really starting to front list those titles on the Wisconsin Digital Library site so that people can get access to those right away. And I would encourage patrons to check out publishers that you may not and authors that you may not have read before in the genres that you like, because there's some great stuff out there that you can get right away.
So this might be an opportunity to push past, well, I always like to read John Grisham, and find other authors who may have similar styles or, you know, similar thrills in the same kind of idea without being from one of the big publishers anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what value does that then add for the smaller authors or the authors who are publishing with smaller companies?
Well, it obviously gives them a choice to have some exposure that they might not have otherwise. And that's another thing that's great about digital materials, is that it allows authors that may not get that sort of front shelf space to have visibility, you know, on the browsing feature of the Wisconsin Digital Library.
Tell us more about that, because I do have this vision of walking into a library and seeing certain books are displayed, or I ask the librarian, you know, I'm kind of in the market for this sort of a read. How do you deal with that when you don't have a face-to-face connection because it's digital?
Right. So the Wisconsin Digital Library has what we call carousels, and they literally rotate through, and you can put different genres on. One of the most popular carousels is Available Now, the Available Now titles, so people can go in and get a book right away. We do different sorts of carousels depending on the time of year. Again, genres, you know, the crime, romance is huge, mystery, that sort of thing.
And so when we have people listening, thinking about investing the time to get an ebook or to read it, learn a new system, and they hear that Macmillan is limiting its options for those new releases to libraries across the state, what could they do about this? How did they weigh in on whether they think this is a good idea?
Sure. There are a couple things. One is the American Library Association has started a campaign called eBooks for All. It's very easy to sign a petition. You know, that's very easy, and educate yourself about what's going on. In addition, I would encourage people to go to their local public libraries. And if they can't get there physically, no problem. Check out their library's website. Every library in Wisconsin has some sort of website that they can access.
Do you think we'll need to see people outside of the library community saying something for any of these policies to change?
Well, there's quite a bit going on behind the scene in the world of librarians. They are advocating, you know, they're in Washington. Chief officers of the State Library Association have been lobbying. They actually met with John Sargent from Macmillan. We are talking to other consortia. So we're doing a lot behind the scenes.
Excellent. Sarah, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Gold is a project manager for the Wisconsin Public Library Consortium. We talked about the new policy from major book publisher Macmillan that changes the way libraries can lend ebooks and how that affects people who want to read new releases. Coming up, we explore the challenges for people with speech or language impairments as they try to navigate the criminal justice system. Have you ever felt at a disadvantage in a courtroom or a police station because of a language barrier? Call us, 800-642-1234. That conversation is just ahead. I'm Keely Boltina, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. When we put our faith in our criminal justice system, we trust that the truth comes out in court. We hold out hope that everyone involved, from judges to juries and lawyers and witnesses, that they're treating everyone fairly, justly. Our guest says that doesn't necessarily happen for people with language disabilities. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Our guest says we should make fewer assumptions about communication and behavior, and we should recognize speech and language differences. Have you ever been to court? Were you involved somehow in the criminal justice system? Do you feel you were treated differently because of the way you communicate? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Join the conversation. Michelle Levine is a distinguished clinical professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. She's also the director of the Public Defender Project, where law students are interns in public defender offices throughout Wisconsin. Michelle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've studied how people with language impairments interact with the criminal justice system. How might someone with a language disability have a different experience with law enforcement?
Well, language impairments are generally a failure to develop full competency in language use, whether we're talking expression or processing or just general expression. People would have trouble with law enforcement, particularly in an interrogation context, because interrogation by its nature is word-based, and police, especially in the United States, are trained essentially to use words as a weapon, for lack of a better way of doing it. And so you often hear the phrase, this is like bringing a knife to a gunfight. Well, a lot of these people, they're basically bringing a stick to a gunfight, because the police will outword them. And that's what we saw. Everybody knows the Brendan Dassey case. That's what we saw there.
And we'll get to that, yeah, in just a few moments. I do want to dig in a little more, though, because what you're saying is as using words as a weapon, I could see law enforcement officers saying, these are interrogation techniques. We're trying to get at the truth. So what's going on there? There's a little bit of clash there.
Well, there is clash. They're trying to get at the truth. If you're trying to get at the truth, the last thing you do is weaponize language. In fact, if you're trying to get at the truth, one of the things you do is not talk. You give the person you're interviewing a chance to talk. You use techniques that draw them out. That's how you get at the truth. It's very different than trying to get at a confession.
And what would it look like to weaponize language? Help us understand what that sounds like.
What it sounds like is, if I ask you how your day went, or I ask you how your day went already, it's 6:30 in the morning, and I say to you, well, how's your day going? But instead of stopping there, I say, did you get up? Did you have coffee? How did you get to work? Tell me how the drive was. Tell me how this was. Tell me how this was. Then, only then, do I give you a chance to answer, maybe. And you start, and you say, well, it was fine. But, and then I start back in at you without ever giving you a chance. Meanwhile, you're just feeling overwhelmed by all of the verbiage I just beat you with.
Sure. And that's that could be the case for anybody, not just people with language impairments. That can be a lot to take in. What does a language impairment encompass? Seems like a really broad term.
It is a broad term because language is a very broad and complex subject. It is a full system that involves meaning, form, and use. There's aspects of language, whether we're talking about vocabulary, syntax, the ability to know what to say when, and then we can keep going from there. What does it look like? It depends on who the person is, how this language difficulty manifests itself. So some people can be very quiet, very withdrawn, very passive. You'll tend to see one-word answers. They'll avoid eye contact. They'll avoid any difficult situations. They'll become very passive, very compliant. There are other people who actually will sometimes talk too much to cover up. There's any number of ways that it will reveal itself. One of the important things to understand is that it won't necessarily be apparent to those dealing with the people, because as these individuals get older, they learn to pass. They learn to cover it up.
And what happens then if a law enforcement official or a judge doesn't recognize or know about that language impairment? How might they interpret the kind of behavior they're seeing?
Well, if we're looking at compliance, they're just going to say, oh, this person understands. This person is going along. If we see single word answers, I'll just say, well, they're responding to the question, so therefore they understand it. If they're saying nothing, they might say they haven't said they don't understand, so apparently they do. Occasionally a judge might see somebody as being rude or abrupt. They may also make assumptions about their credibility because the person isn't making eye contact, which we tend to associate with credibility. So there's any number of ways that it can, but it is so common, not only for law enforcement and judges, but for people's own lawyers to make assumptions that people understand when in fact they don't.
Do we have any data comparing how often people with language impairments are convicted compared to people who don't have those challenges?
Well, here's what we know. In the general public, language impairments or language disorders are at about 7%. The studies that happen in correctional institutions and with people on probation range anywhere from 3 times that. So in other words, you're running at about 20 to 25% of the population in a given institution, all the way up to 70% in certain juvenile institutions.
And why would juvenile institutions be different maybe than the way that we are handling adults?
Well, it's unclear. First of all, we send kids to prisons, to juvenile prisons, for different reasons. Kids will get in trouble for behavior at school, and that sort of begins what they call the school to prison pipeline or the school to juvenile corrections pipeline. The thing is that very often behavior problems, especially in school, are directly linked with language impairments, but the schools have missed it, and then the lawyers miss it, and then the police miss it, and then the judges miss it.
We're discussing the criminal justice system's treatment of people with speech or language impairments, and our guide is Michelle Levine, a UW law professor and former public defender. I'm Keely Boltina, and you can be part of this conversation about language disabilities and the courts. 800-642-1234. Are you a prosecutor, a public defender? Maybe you're a police officer. Have you seen people with language impairments at a disadvantage in the criminal justice system? Maybe you're one of them. 800-642-1234. Michelle, you teamed up with a speech pathologist to examine the case of Brendan Dassey. You mentioned him briefly earlier. He was convicted with his uncle, Stephen Avery, of brutally murdering a freelance photographer. And the case was also it got a lot of attention because there was a Netflix series about it. Brendan was a teenager when he was convicted, turned 30 last month. How did you go about studying this case and his treatment by law enforcement?
We started really in a very nuts and bolts way. Both Dr. Miles and I looked at making a murderer, and I asked her, just looking at the segment in that show, did she think that there was a language disorder? And she said yes, based upon a number of different behavioral cues. Obviously, we looked at the entire interrogations. We got those through open records requests. We then took all of this and sent it to a company called the, I believe it's Systemic or Systematic Analysis of Language Transcriptions. They basically transcribe interviews as a, really what you're going to see, this is a hyper-technical transcript with all sorts of markings that shows delays, overlaps, types of language.
So it's not just the words that were said, but really the way they were said too.
Exactly. And if I were to show it to you, you'd see all sorts of markings that to somebody like me, a lay person in this, it looks very, very strange. They're quite difficult to read, but they are very difficult or very different than a traditional transcript, which only shows the words that were said. From there, Dr. Miles looked at the kinds of questions that were used, the number of words that were used, who spoke when, and from there came out with a quite the amazing quantitative analysis.
And what did you determine about how you see Brendan Dassey's language impairment impacting his experience with law enforcement?
Well, start with this. We discovered that he had a language impairment by simply looking at the court records. Sitting in there was a speech language analysis from 6 weeks before the homicide. And this kid had a severe language impairment in just about every single realm. His language abilities ranged from that of a high, an 11-year-old, down to a 5-year-old. So we knew pretty quickly, we could say he's got a real serious problem. Then we compared it with the way that the police department used language. And it was actually quite shocking because we discovered the police talked more than three times as much as Brendan. There are certain rules for interrogation or interviewing that involve allowing the interviewed subject to speak. They did everything but they asked leading questions. They asked, believe it or not, multiple choice questions. They asked hundreds of yes, no questions. The kind of open-ended, true open-ended question that was supposed to be used in an interview of a child, particularly a disabled child, was less than 2%.
We're talking with guest Michelle Levine. She's a clinical law professor, and we've been talking about the case of Brendan Dassey and also more broadly language impairments and how people who have them interact with law enforcement and with our court system. So what's your take? 800-642-1234. Do you think that judges and lawyers, law enforcement officers have a good grasp of this? Do they realize how differently abled people interact with the justice system? Or do you think it's easy to misinterpret? Share your story with us. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. This conversation continues right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin is now 15 years into a program that certifies interpreters for court. Ahead of 2004, judges and court staff pushed to improve language services from one to another. It makes sense on face value. Quality communication is crucial in court. But what happens when somebody speaks English? Someone appears totally fluent and able to understand, but has disabilities. Our guest says they don't get a fair chance. Join the conversation. Do you have a communication disability? How is your experience different than people assume? Do you worry whether the criminal justice system actually offers a fair shot? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Our guest, Michelle Levine, a law professor at UW Law School, stays with us. And we want to welcome George in Appleton to the conversation. George, thanks for your call.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning. What question do you have?
Well, I'm just curious, are there any efforts at using some sort of screening tool early on when juveniles find themselves in the system? I would think it would make sense to, have some sort of I don't know, some sort of effort to screen people for these issues prior to, you know, the court momentum and that kind of thing.
George, thanks for the question. Michelle, what do we know about how we screen people, especially kids, for language impairments?
Thank you for that great question, George. We are dependent on the schools to do it, and that's very hit and miss. Other countries are actually picking this up. For example, in Canada, if a kid is identified as a behavior problem, one of the first things they do is a language screening. So we're dependent on the schools. Schools do have speech language pathologists, but like other special ed services, they're spread very thin. Once it gets into the system, at least in the United States, has yet to recognize that this is an issue. And so while we have moved forward a great deal with interpreters, the notion that somebody would speak English and still need communication services, it just hasn't registered yet.
Yeah, and if they aren't diagnosed, what can the system do to accommodate disabilities if they're not known? Is there a way we can approach it with making fewer assumptions about the way people should act?
I think for starters, we have to just generally change the way that we communicate. I would encourage everybody to go to their local courthouse and take a look at what a guilty plea looks like. And I challenge them to tell me what was actually said. We just talk about a barrage of verbiage, and it always ends with the question, do you understand? And people invariably say yes, because they don't want to look stupid. That's a natural impulse. I am going to put this one on my lawyer friends, and as a lawyer, I have to take some responsibility for this too. We have to start to look for the cues. What signs are there that this person may have a language impairment? And there are ways of looking. We know, for example, it is often associated with auditory processing deficits. It's very commonly shows up with ADHD. If I am representing a kid or a young adult who had been identified as a behavior problem, that should be a red flag to me. Get this tested. And honestly, it's not that hard to have a basic speech language assessment done by a speech language pathologist.
So there are things that people who are helping to orchestrate the system can do. Madeline from Green Bay called to ask why police were allowed to interrogate Brendan Dassey the way that they did. Michelle, what rules do police or courts follow when they're working with people who have language impairments?
The same rules they follow for anybody. If you take a look at all of the cases that involve this, there is nothing that differentiates the way that a kid should be interviewed, the way that an adult should be interviewed, the way a disabled adult or child should be interviewed. Courts have so far to go to understand that the behavior of the police directly affects, one, the veracity and the reliability of the information that they get, and two, whether or not somebody, in fact, voluntarily spoke with them. We are in the dark ages on this one.
We're talking about language impairments and how the criminal justice system handles people who have them. Our guest is Michelle Levine, who teaches criminal law, professional responsibility, and trial advocacy at the UW Law School. I'm Keely Boltina. There's still time for you. Are you a criminal justice worker, maybe a lawyer or an officer? Maybe you're a certified court interpreter. Call 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. There's still time to join the conversation. Michelle, as a lawyer, you represented deaf clients. Tell us about those experiences. How are people who are deaf seen differently in our system?
Well, again, this took a long time to get to. For a long time, there was a belief that you just had to plunk an interpreter, any old interpreter, in front of a deaf person and they would understand. We have now gotten to the point where we understand interpreters must be skilled, must be certified, and that one interpreter is not the same as another, and that one deaf person isn't the same as another. To the extent that accommodations are made and that there's an understanding of the need for alternate communication styles, deaf people are, in a very paradoxical way, ahead of people with language impairments, hearing people with language impairments, because we can't see a language impairment in a hearing person, and we don't know what it looks like, and it really isn't on our radar yet.
Sure, but with people who are deaf, you can physically, there's a physical difference there that you have to deal with.
It's there. It is right. It is absolutely right in front of you.
And when you represented clients who were deaf, what did you realize about how much we really understand about people with disabilities in court?
Well, that really was my first foray into actually great disappointment. We don't know very much about disabilities at all. At that time, when I started representing deaf people, there really was very little understanding. We thought we could pass notes and that they would understand it. We thought we just had to just drop an interpreter into a traditional service and everything would be fine. We really don't understand it. We still see things through our own frame of reference. Law types like me, like judges, well, we're verbal people. You know, the joke is we all went to law school because we couldn't do math, and we use words, and that's what we do. And we can't imagine what it's like to not have them. And so we just think, well, this person is just being shy. This person is just being reluctant. This person is just being rude, without recognizing, wait a minute, there's a whole other world here that we're not seeing.
Could that be the case, too, beyond just disabilities and into, cultural ways of people talking, depending on where you are in this state or what your family background is? I can just see how that vantage point of, well, this is how I view the world could encourage us to make assumptions or judgments about people who talk differently than the way we do.
Absolutely. I will take something as simple as the difference between yeah and yes. There are judges, I've appeared in front of them, who get angry when a defendant says yeah in response to a question because the judge sees that as a lack of respect for authority. That's how the person talks. They would say yeah to the president of the United States. That's how they speak. Other things are behavioral cues like eye contact. In certain cultures and in certain parts of the world, you do not make eye contact with a person in authority. Here in our world, we equate eye contact with a willingness to engage honestly. Those are two very different worldviews and can get a person into some serious trouble if the person doing the listening isn't tuned in.
What can we learn from how other nations address this issue? We've really been talking about the U.S. criminal justice system. Are there places who are doing it differently?
Yes. Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand. One of the things they've started doing is bringing in communication specialists whenever a person with a language impairment is dealing with the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system in any way. In Northern Ireland, they even have them in during interrogations because the idea is the people who are doing the questioning, the people in charge, don't understand how their communication is causing the entire enterprise to break down.
Michelle, thank you for helping us better understand this morning.
Thank you.
Michelle Levine is a distinguished clinical professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Host Kate Archer-Kent is back tomorrow. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.